And I want to welcome you all to our Personal Theology Speaker Series, which is weekly here, May through September. Our speaker today is Nicoletta Karam, who's a Bay Area educator and author of two books, including The 9/11 Backlash, which is a definitive book on the forgotten victims of 9/11. And she didn't bring any today, unfortunately, but she's passed out some information about her subject here, and there's, if anybody didn't get one, there's more on the back table. Nicoletta graduated with honors from Swarthmore College, where she was an editor of the Phoenix and a correspondent for the New York Times. She has a degree in Arabic from the University of Alexandria, Egypt, and a PhD in Arab and American history from Brandeis University. The title of her talk this morning is Khalil Gibran's Pen Bond, Feminism and Spirituality in Jazz Age New York. And she may be speaking a little longer today. We may not have quite as much time for questions. She has a long talk. So let's give a very warm welcome to Nicoletta Karam.
Thank you for being here today. I got interested in this topic when I was growing up. I heard stories about my grandfather's first wife, and I'd hear stories about how she was an Arabic novelist. She wrote three novels in Arabic. She edited a newspaper on women, and she was a suffragette, and she also edited the biggest Arabic newspaper in the country, Al-Huda, and she was also a translator. And even though she was so significant, you never hear about Arab American women when you take American history courses. And I learned that she was part of a larger Arabic literary movement in New York, and it was the Emigrant School of Arabic Literature. And it was the center person of this movement was Khalil Gibran, who many people know through his famous book, The Prophet. But he was part of a much larger Arabic literary community in New York, and he formulated a group called the Pen Bond, in which 10 writers met in his New York studio every month for more than a decade. And so this group of very influential writers and poets is studied throughout the Middle East. Everybody who takes an Egyptian high school exit exam has to know these writers, but people in the United States have never even heard of them. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about these writers as well as their views on feminism and spirituality. To give you a little bit more information about their background, they were Christians fleeing the Ottoman Empire in the late 19th century. They were primarily Maronite, which is very similar to Catholic, as well as being Greek Orthodox. But they really were trying to get away from organized religion. They were sort of hippie Arabs, if that's one way of thinking about it. They settled primarily in New York, Boston, and some in Louisiana because Louisiana was French-speaking and Catholic. And they spoke several languages. They spoke Arabic, English. Most spoke French because of the French influence in Lebanon, which at that time was all known as Syria. Lebanon wasn't created yet. And many also spoke Russian because they attended Russian imperial schools in the Middle East as well as in the Ukraine. So they were very familiar with world literature, especially French and Russian novelists. And they published in the Arabic press, which is why Americans don't know about them, because most Americans can't read Arabic. They were writing at a time when Orientalism was the rage. Rudolph Valentino's Chic and movies like The Thief of Baghdad were captivating American audiences. King Tut's tomb was recently discovered, and many female fans were very excited by exotic Oriental men. So these writers were primarily interested in five questions. First, how should literary conventions be reformulated? Two, how should gender roles be redefined? Number three, how should outdated political systems be replaced? Number four, how should binary insider-outsider paradigms of belonging be rethought? And five, how should individuals develop a personal theology to replace outmoded religious institutions? So I'm going to talk to you about the first area they were concerned about, which is updating literary conventions. Now, many people don't know about Arabic poetry, but it's very, very conventional. It's written in two columns known as hemistiches, and it's always written in monorhyme and monometer. There are 16 meters in Arabic poetry. poetry. You have to pick one, and they're very, very complicated. And then you have to continue that one Arabic meter through the entire poem, as well as keeping into the two columns and keeping the monorhyme. So it's kind of like a chess game. You have to be very, very specific and know exactly what you're going to do. So these writers were against this. So they broke away from monorhyme. They wrote poetry in stanzas. They broke away from monometer, sometimes putting different Arabic meters within the same poem, or even writing prose poetry. They got away from the two-columned poetry. And in the packets, you can see some of the different examples of this. They also developed new literary approaches. They wrote bilingual poetry. They also wrote humorous poetry. Now, Arabic poetry was considered very serious. In the pre-Islamic period, people would have poetry contests in Mecca at the Kaaba, and the winners of the poetry contest, their poems would be hung. So Arabic poetry was very, very taken very, very seriously. And even in the Quran, you have the classical Arabic meters in the Quran, and one actual proof of the Quran is it's so beautiful, only God could have created it. So I think that's sort of an interesting proof of God. But these American writers, these Arab American writers, were writing on humorous topics. They were exploring new themes. They were doing experiments with narrative voice, oftentimes doing a story out of chronological order with many narratives within the same story, and including colloquial Arabic. Now, many people don't know there's classical Arabic and colloquial Arabic, and they're very different. It's about, like, Latin is to the Romance languages is what classical Arabic or Fusa is to the different dialects of Arabic, which is why most Arabs, when they meet, can't really understand each other very well if they're speaking totally different dialects. So these writers, instead of writing in the classical Arabic, which is basically 7th century Arabian Arabic, they were sometimes writing using colloquial Arabic, which is very revolutionary. So now I'm going to read you a little bit of their poetry. And I'm going to start with Ilya Abu Mahdi, who is my personal favorite. I think he's the most amazing poet. And this poem is called The Sea. And it's a poem about the meaning of life, but it's also about the meaning of poetry, because there's all sorts of puns that occur in the poem. The sea in Arabic also means the meter. So he's also talking about Arabic meter. And when he talks about the sand, one of the meters in Arabic poetry is ramal, which also means sand. So he's making all sorts of literary puns within the poem. So this is an excerpt from the poem. Man, I came not knowing. My feet saw the way, and I walked there, and I shall continue, whether I so desire or not. How did I come? How see the path? I know not. Old or new is this existence? Am I free or fettered? Do I lead myself, or am I led? I wish I knew. I know not. And my path, what is it? Long or short? Is there an answer to this riddle, or must it be forever unsolved? I do not know. Why I do not know, I know not. The sea. I ask the sea, do I come from you? Is it true what some say of you? Is it true or a lie? The waves laughed and called, I do not know. See, how many centuries have passed over you? Does the shore know it's kneeling before you? See, I asked the clouds if they remembered our sand. In your depths, a ceaseless war has raged. Are you cradle or tomb? I do not know. How many kings at night built pleasure domes beside you? The morning came and found nothing but mist. Will they return, these kings? Are they deep in the sand? The sand said, I do not know. So just think, he's doing this while keeping the two columns, the monorhyme and the monometer. You know how hard that is? It's just amazing. Now, Gibran was less traditional than Ilya Abu Mahdi, but he also wrote in two columns this excerpt from the processions. And what he did is he has two different narrative voices that he does in two different meters. And the youth of the forest is getting away from monorhyme, so that part of the poem is not in monorhyme and is in one meter. And then the sage of the city is in a classical meter that is in monorhyme. So he's sort of playing with meter in interesting ways. The youth says, "Give me the flute and sing. Forget distress and care, for people are lines which are written not with ink, but with water. Would that I knew what good there is in throng and crowd, in strife and clamor, argument and quarrel. They are all but tunnels of moles, threads in the spider's web, for he who lives in weakness slowly will die." And then the sage refuses to enter the woods, and this is again in a different Arabic meter, exclaiming, "Forest is the abode of life, and were the days gathered in my hand, there would I strew them. But time is that which chooses from my soul. Whatever I long for forest, time bars the way with excuses. The fates have ways unaltering, and men's aims are beyond their impotent reach." So this is about the contrasting paths open to man. So it's just a really sort of interesting poem that shows sort of experiments in literary technique. In his poem, The Madmen, Khalil Gibran uses different meters all over the place to sort of explore how using different meters can complement the subject matter. And this book was may have been influenced by the popularity of psychology in the United States, the emerging field of psychology. And he writes, "One day, long before many gods were born, I awoke from a deep sleep and found all my masks were stolen. The seven masks I fashioned and worn in seven lives. I ran maskless through the crowded street shouting, 'Thieves, thieves, cursed thieves!' And as if in a trance, I cried, 'Blessed, blessed are the thieves who stole my masks.' Thus I became a madman, and I have found both freedom and safety in my madness, the freedom of loneliness and the safety of being understood, for those who understand us enslave something in us. But let me not be too proud of my safety. Even a thief in jail is safe from another thief." So again, he's doing all of this while using traditional Arabic meters. So it's really sort of an amazing literary accomplishment. And the last piece I wanted to, actually two more I wanted to just touch on very quickly. This is a short story by Abdelmasih Haddad called School of Expatriation. And in this story, it's a short story about a Syrian immigrant who is in a cafe, and he keeps switching between different Arabic dialects. So when he talks about the poor state of Syrian schools, he uses the Syrian dialect in Arabic. When he talks about Egyptian history and politics, he uses the Egyptian dialect. And so in a sense, he almost has lost his real true identity because he keeps switching between all these different dialects. And the reason this story is so interesting as it shows the these writers' willingness to write in colloquial Arabic, which was not done. So again, classical Arabic, the language of the Quran, was considered almost sacred. It's almost many Arabs, even though these were Christian Arabs, but in the Middle East, the classical Arabic is almost considered to be like the language of God, and you don't mess with it. So this was a very important thing. And the last piece of sort of literary the last literary work I wanted to talk about is Nasip Arida's Tale of the Samsama, because it's just a beautiful story. An immigrant goes to the Metropolitan Museum of Art and sees a sword, and it's actually the sword of Abdullah, the last Arab prince of Andalus, you know, in Spain. And he starts speaking in Arabic to the sword, and the sword wakes up and all of a sudden starts narrating the history of Arab civilization, the rise and fall. And the sword becomes a symbol of finished power and glory. When the sword was in use, Arab power was in its ascendancy. And when it was in disuse and decorated with all these ornate jewels that don't have any purpose, Arab power became on the wane. And the sword becomes a symbol of the transitory nature of power, glory, and fertility. But the immigrant who meets the sword is separated from the sword by a glass casing. So he is also impotent in his U.S. environment because he can't access the sword. So again, this shows sort of the writer's willingness to explore interesting themes using science fiction or fantasy, you know, to sort of explore different topics. So that's sort of how they were trying to sort of revitalize and modernize literature and traditional Arabic poetry. They also were interested in tackling gender roles. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the gender revolution they were trying to achieve in their writing. And often what they would do is they would have characters with different ideas in dialogue in a story or in a novel. So it's up to the reader to sort of explore their own views on gender and the place of women by reading these books and hearing these contrasting voices. So they question the institution of marriage. They question the sexual and economic exploitation of women. They were against polygamy. They were against racism. They questioned why women were treated better if they were able to produce an heir and why they were unfairly blamed if a couple was infertile. They challenged the institution of arranged marriage. They challenged religious education. They suggested adultery may be preferable to a loveless marriage. This is very radical. They proposed that a woman might be able to choose pregnancy and single motherhood if she wanted to. So these were very radical people, particularly Arab writers around the early decades of the 20th century. So I'm going to talk to you very briefly about Afifa Karam and some of her books. So in her first book, Badia and Fuad, which she wrote in the first decade of the 20th century, it's about the dual burdens of sexism and poverty. It's about the sexual and economic exploitation of vulnerable immigrant women. So, for example, on the boat to America, a sailor is making advances at these poor women, and the women, you know, don't know what to do, and they're under a lot of economic pressure. And so Afifa Karam tackles that in this story. Also, the two heroines of the story, Badia and Lucia, they talk about how manual labor they have to do is really humiliating, with one commenting, "There's no difference between us and the cattle." So this is really sort of interesting feminism. She becomes more and more radical in her feminism in her other novels. In her second book, Fatima the Bedouin, she challenged the authority of corrupt priests and criticized religious hypocrisy and bigotry. The story revolves around a Muslim woman named Fatima who falls in love with a Christian man named Selim. The priest, however, refused to wed them, so to find a way of getting married, they immigrate to the United States where they have a secular or civil marriage. But even in the United States, Fatima is not welcome as the legitimate wife because her marriage was not consecrated in a church. So she becomes a social outcast in the community. And she says, "Why do people think I'm worth nothing? Where are my rights? If the man gets shame with me, he has to share the punishment." So it's sort of about some of the challenges women face. And her final novel, The Girl of Amshit, is probably her most radical. She criticizes the religious education of girls, the problems of arranged marriages, and how girls are not prepared for the marriages they're sort of forced into. In this story, the protagonist, Farida, was wed at a young age to a rich older man to appease her father. She asks her father, "What does marriage mean?" And the marriage ends up being a disaster. And she later comments, "What 14-year-old girl could comprehend the meaning of love and marriage? She just wasn't prepared. She had no idea what she was getting into." And Farida's father, instead of making sure she had a suitable wedding, he put the bridle of obedience in her mouth. And Farida tells her husband, "Why don't I have rights over you as you have over me? You've just turned me into a machine to satisfy your needs." So this is, again, very radical feminism. Now, the thing that's really interesting is the male writers of this literary community were even more radical. Mikhail Naimi, who's just an amazing writer, he was the one that studied in the Ukraine, you know, was just a very radical feminist and attacked patriarchal values in his story, The Barren One. It's the story of Jamila, a Syrian woman who is blamed for her childless marriage to Aziz. So initially their marriage is very wonderful. Aziz treats her very nicely. She's expected that she's going to produce an heir for the family. When she can't conceive, she's treated horribly. So what happens? She hears a story about if you go to this religious retreat, there's a miraculous cure that happens. So she goes up there and she comes back pregnant, and everyone all of a sudden treats her like a, you know, wonderful woman again. She's embraced by her family. And then she kills herself after revealing she had an affair with a priest, and that's the miraculous cure, and says, "The barren one was you," to her husband in the note. So it's about, you know, women are not just childbearing vessels, and women's worth doesn't or shouldn't depend on their fertility. Gibran was even more radical than Naomi. In his 1910 story, Rose Haney, the story is about a loveless marriage between a Syrian woman and a wealthy but nice older man. But Rose Haney doesn't love her husband. You know, he's nice, he provides for her financially, but she just doesn't love him. So she leaves him and shacks up with a young lover. And for this, she's ostracized by the community. But she explains to visitors that she had felt like a prostitute while she was living with her husband. But now that she's living with her husband, she feels like she's reclaimed her virtuous character because she was true to herself. So this, again, is very radical feminism, especially an Arabic story written in 1910. But the most radical, and if I could marry any of these writers, I would marry Amin Rahani. He's like my ideal guy. So he wrote a story called Juhan, or Out of the Harem, and it's the story of a liberated Turkish feminist who decides to have a baby out of wedlock because she wanted one. She leaves her Turkish husband because she doesn't love him and he takes a second wife. So she decides to just go off on her own and, you know, become a nurse and a radical feminist and journalist, and then ends up having an affair with a German general, von Wallenstein, in part because she wants to help her imprisoned father, but she also just wants to have a baby. So General von Wallenstein wants to marry her, but she refuses, and instead ends up actually killing him. And basically, Rahani uses this story as a means of challenging imperialist fiction of people like Pierre Loti, who wrote Madame Chrysanthemum, in which a foreign European man conquers the country by conquering a foreign woman. Does everyone sort of understand the concept? So Rihani is challenging this formula by telling the story from the perspective of the foreign woman who conquers the European invader, in a sense, and her child is going to be the liberator, the product of East and West, who will rise up against imperialism and create a more just international system. So now I'm going to go on to the next area that they were interested in, which is how to modernize the political system, and how do you as a political actor act in a good way politically if war is bad and patriotism is bad and political maneuvering is really sort of unseemly, but you want to create a more just world. So they explored a lot of this in their poetry and their writings. So how should individuals act to modernize the political order? And they're, again, responding to the stagnant Ottoman Empire and unfair European occupations. So Gibran was writing poetry on political topics, but he was not jingoistic and would often write emotional poetry even when he was doing it to bolster the war effort. And he even wrote poetry to help Syrian famine victims of the war and to rally the troops. So in his 1918 poem, Defeat, he was writing to rally Serbian troops in Kosovo. But it's a really beautiful poem, and it's very interesting because it wasn't jingoistic at all. Defeat, my defeat, my self-knowledge and defiance. In you I found aloneness and the joy of being shunned and scorned. Defeat, my shining sword and shield. In your eyes I have read that to be enthroned is to be enslaved, and to be understood is to be leveled down, and to be grasped is but to reach one's fullness, like a ripe fruit to fall and be consumed. Defeat, my deathless courage, you and I shall laugh together with the storm, and together we shall dig graves for all what die in us, and we shall stand together in the sun with the will, and we shall be dangerous. Isn't that beautiful? Now, Mikhail Naimi actually fought in World War I on the side of the Americans, and he often explored the destructiveness of war in his poetry. So he wrote a really beautiful poem called My Brother. And again, a lot of times he's doing this using conventional Arabic meter, which is also what makes the poem so amazing. Brother, if after the war the man of the West celebrates his deeds, praising the memory of those who died and glorifying the valor of his heroes, do not sing for those who have won the day, and do not rejoice over the misfortune of those who have yielded in surrender. Rather, kneel down in silence, as I do, with humble bleeding heart, that we may weep the fate of our dead. Dear brother, who are we with no country, no people, no neighbor? When we sleep and when we wake, we put on shame and dishonor. The world smells rotten with our stench as it is smelled with our dead. So bring the spade and follow me that we may dig another trench in which to bury our living. So I just think it's really an amazing poem. Now, Amin Rahani was also active in World War I, but what he chooses to do is very different. He decides he's going to travel down to Mexico and get all the Syrians in Mexico to get the Mexican government to join the war on the side of the Allies. So he travels by boat, and he meets, you know, H.G. Wells on the boat, and, you know, has a very interesting time. And he goes to Merida, and he tries to organize the Syrians to get Mexico to join the war effort. And instead, the Mexican government kicks out Rahani, but also kicks out his arch nemesis, the German ambassador to Mexico, Heinrich von Eckhart, who is actually the recipient of the Zimmermann telegram. So that's sort of their response to preserving Mexican neutrality. But he wrote Letters to Uncle Sam, a novel about this, and it reads like a Twain story. It's very funny and very pessimistic about sort of the folly of ever accomplishing anything. And the last political work I wanted to talk about, which is just amazing, is by another member of Gibran's pen bond. He wrote this Arabic short story, Butran 2520, which is a science fiction story about a utopian society. So the world in the future is run by a world government, and it's like an academic conference. People are vegetarian. They've transcended religion. People live to be 100 because you can get replacement organs. There's lots of music and cultural activities. A vegetarian scholar by the name of Esther Levy presides, and she introduces a historian that relates the story of the previous centuries before people, you know, had all the things that they have in the future. So, you know, they also lament all the religious superstition and the harm it did to previous generations. So again, they were writing science fiction, fantasy, feminist work, really interesting poetry. The fourth area I wanted to talk about is the crisis of belonging. Who am I? Where do I belong? And the immigrant becomes a symbol of lost modern man. So the question they center on is, how can insider-outsider paradigms of belonging be reformulated? Now, Abdelmasih Haddad wrote a number of stories that are just really amazing. His most famous is In the House of the Dead, which is just so funny. In this story, there's a funeral. There's a man who's died, and his coffin is in the house, and everyone's sort of visiting the house and paying respects to the mourners. And he doesn't really know what to do. So a friend takes him along. He's like, just sort of follow along after me, and I'll walk you through everything. So he goes in, you know, and sits down, and he's really nervous. And his friend says, you know, I want to offer some words, and tells this beautiful parable about the death of Alexander the Great. After Alexander the Great died, Alexander the Great's mother was really, really upset. So one of the visitors at the funeral to Alexander the Great said, He who is without loss eat the first bite, and nobody ate anything. And she realized everyone has suffering in their lives. Everyone experiences loss. So the family of the deceased were very comforted by this wonderful parable. And the narrator thinks, wow, why couldn't I have said something profound like that? I feel like a fish out of water. I have no idea how to behave in these kinds of situations. And he's very discouraged with himself and is very down on himself. But then a new group of visitors arrive, and they sit down, and one of them repeats the same parable about the death of Alexander the Great. And the narrator's thinking, wait, we just heard this. You know, what's going on? And a few minutes later, another group comes, and someone says the same parable again. And he realizes that the parable has almost lost its meaning, and all these rituals are kind of ridiculous, where this poor family has to listen to group after group say the same things, and it's become a really hackneyed story, and it's not moving at all. So it's about what is the role of tradition, and how do we navigate, you know, getting rid of traditions? Are they useful or not? He also wrote many other stories about the immigrant experience in America. In one, an immigrant store owner has a shop, and someone asks, well, do you have insurance? And he points to a picture of Saint Antonius, and someone says, what do you mean? What's that? He's like, oh, the saint is protecting my store. And the guy says, you can't, you know, have a saint protecting your store. You need real insurance in case something happens. So he's convinced to sort of get rid of the picture and instead buy actual insurance for the store. And a fire comes along and burns down the store, and people think it's arson, which it wasn't, and he ends up being put in jail. And he says, I wish I had stuck with the traditional insurance of St. Antonius. That wouldn't have happened. So it's about what are the consequences of abandoning faith and tradition. And then in another short story, His Grace, a man who is a big deal in the old world comes into an Arabic cafe every day and sort of holds court and orders things and always says, put it on my tab, put it on my tab, and then leaves without paying. And another customer asked the shop owner, why do you let him preload, you know, and just order stuff every day? And he says, well, he is nothing if not a dawook. You know, he's nothing if not, you know, an important person. So it's about the decline in stature some people experience when they come to the New World, and how do you honor previous obligations and respect people and give them humanity. Mikhail Naimi also wrote short stories and novels about the question of belonging, and his famous work is The Cuckoo Clock. A protagonist is a Lebanese villager who's very happy, very contented, and he's engaged to a beautiful village woman named Esmeralda. And they're about to get married when all of a sudden a man returns from America with all sorts of newfangled gadgets, including galoshes and an umbrella and a cuckoo clock. So Esmeralda ditches her fiancé and goes off with this returning man who has the cuckoo clock. So the narrator realizes he needs a cuckoo clock. If he wants to get a real good woman, he needs a cuckoo clock. So he immigrates to the United States. He works hard his whole life, and he buys a big cuckoo clock, which he presents to his new bride in America. And she looks at the thing, and she's like, why did you buy this old-fashioned thing? It's really garish and awful. And he realizes, you know, his journey was like the experience of the cuckoo clock, where you're constantly chasing something, and it's ridiculous. So it's very philosophical. He also wrote The Pitted Face, which is a lot like The Stranger by Camus. The narrator is a mute waiter with a pockmarked face who has no idea of who he is, but he serves others in silence. And we know of him because of his journal, which is found by customers after he's disappeared. And we discover that Pitted Face is haunted by glimpses of a murder he may have committed but cannot remember. And in a fugue state, he writes, I slew my love with my own hand, for it was more than my body could feed and less than my soul hungered after. And the readers are wondering, by killing his lover, did he kill or reclaim the essence of his self? So it's a very existential piece. And Amin Rahani also wrote The Book of Khalid about a wandering immigrant, and it really reminded me of Ellison's Invisible Man, where Khalid is continuously reinventing himself as a peddler, politician, criminal. He lives in a hovel where he has, as wallpaper, pages of all the important books on the wall, Thomas Paine's, you know, novels and, you know, writings and novels by all the great writers, and then he burns them. And so it's sort of, he adapts different credos and then burns them. So it's a really interesting book. So that gives you sort of an idea of their writings on the quest for belonging and that their interest in that theme. And now, to sort of end, I wanted to talk about their final crisis, which is a religious crisis. They were very tired of traditional religions. They didn't think organized religion was a real good fit for them. So they went on sort of a spiritual quest, and they sampled from lots of different religious traditions. They went to Some went to India. One, Rouhani, my favorite, obviously, went to meet Gandhi but was turned away because Gandhi was in jail and the jailer wouldn't let him actually into the jail, but was interested in Hinduism. They were interested in Zoroastrianism and Buddhism and Islam and Judaism and Christianity. So they went on a wonderful spiritual quest, and their religious writings reflect that. Now, Rouhani wrote The Triple Alliance in the Animal Kingdom, which there's a picture of sort of, it looks like an animal farm illustration, but he wrote this in 1903. And in this, it's a futuristic story where the animals have lost their jobs following industrialization, so you no longer need horses anymore, and there's this sort of religious fundamentalist backlash as a result. And the atheist fox is put on trial by other animals for heresy. So the fox contends that the lioness did not have a virgin birth and questions the divinity of the lion and whether the lion was actually a three-headed deity or not and whether Jonah could have lived inside the belly of a whale. And, you know, he's put on trial and tortured, and it's like Orwell's Animal Farm. And so he uses animals to challenge his readers' religious views and raise questions about, obviously, the virgin birth, the Trinity, and other sort of implausibilities in biblical stories. So Rouhani was actually an atheist, and I found, you know, speeches he gave on atheism, and he was just very, very radical in his beliefs. He also, though, you know, was interested in other faiths. He also did a wonderful translation of an Abbasid Arabic poet called The Luzumiyat of Abu Ala al-Mawri, and he did this showing that he was very interested in sort of Arabic, it's almost Sufism. You know, he wrote on lots of different religious topics. He traveled extensively through Arabia and wrote a book on Ibn Saud of Arabia. So he had many different interests. Naimi wrote the Book of Murdad, which was about his personal theology, as told by the character Murdad, who was a stowaway on Noah's Ark. And this character, Murdad, celebrates vegetarianism and many different religious traditions are sort of blended together in the Book of Murdad. And Gibran was also interested in many different religious traditions, and I've included some of his drawings that shows his interest in different faiths, as well as pictures of the female crucified, a drawing that looks very much like an Indian deity with many arms, the Heavenly Mother. So he's sort of drawing upon many different religious traditions. And he wrote many novels or poetry works that explore different religious questions. In Jesus, the Son of Man, he gives varying perspectives on the story of Jesus, and it's reminiscent of Nikos Katsenzakis' controversial writings on the life of Jesus. So Khalil Gibran's The Prophet is his most famous work, which gives musings on the meaning of life as told by a narrator, Mustafa, who's a prophet who is leaving the city of Orphalese to depart. The narrator shares his thoughts on different life topics, such as marriage, children, and religion, which captures Gibran's personal theology. And I'm just going to read the excerpt on marriage, on children, and on religion, and then we'll pause for questions after that. So many people may have gone to weddings, particularly in the 70s, where this is read. So this is the prophet's words on marriage. So someone asks, "What of marriage, Master?" And Mustafa answered, saying, "You were born together, and together you shall be forevermore. You shall be together when the white wings of death scatter your days. Aye, you shall be together even in the silent memory of God. But let there be spaces in your togetherness, and let the winds of the heavens dance between you. Love one another, but make not a bond of love. Let it rather be a moving sea between the shores of your souls. Fill each other's cup, but drink not from the same cup. Give one another of your bread, but eat not from the same loaf. Sing and dance together and be joyous, but let each one of you be alone, even as the strings of a lute are alone, though they quiver with the same music. Give your hearts, but not into each other's keeping,
For only the hand of life can contain your hearts, and stand together, yet not too near together. For the pillars of the temple stand apart, and the oak tree and the cypress grow not in each other's shadows. And then he also wrote on children, and being a mother, I find this particularly interesting. Your children are not your children. They are the sons and daughters of life's longing for itself. They come through you, but not from you, and though they are with you, they belong not to you. You may give them your love, but not your thoughts, for they have their own thoughts. You may house their bodies, but not their souls, for their souls dwell in the house of tomorrow, which you cannot visit, not even in your dreams. You may strive to be like them, but seek not to make them like you, for life goes not backward, nor tarries with yesterday. You are the bows from which your children as living arrows are sent forth. The archer sees the mark upon the path of the infinite, and he bends you with his might that his arrows may go swift and far. Let your bending in the archer's hand be for gladness, for even as he loves the arrow that flies, so he also loves the bow that is stable. And then he also writes on religion. And an old priest said to the prophet Mustafa, "Speak to us of religion." And Mustafa said, "Have I spoken this day of aught else? Is not religion all deeds and all reflection, and that which is neither deed nor reflection, but a wonder and a surprise ever springing in the soul, even while the hands hew the stone or tend the loom? Who can separate his faith from his actions or his belief from his occupations? Who can spread his hours before him saying, 'This is for God and this is for myself. This is for my soul and this other for my body'? Your daily life is your temple and your religion. Whatever you enter into it, take with it your all. Take the plow and the forge and the mallet and the lute, the things you have fashioned in necessity or for delight. For in your reverie, you cannot rise above your achievements, nor fall lower than your failures. And take with you all men, for in adoration, you cannot fly higher than their hopes, nor humble yourself lower than their despair. If you would know God, you shall see him waving his hand in trees." And that's it. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Nikki. They're beautiful thoughts in those lines. So we'll open it up to questions now and wait for the microphone.
Thank you. You've opened up a whole new world that I didn't know was out there. My question to you is there a community now, an Arabic or whatever community, that is aware of their history?
Well, basically, basically, in the Middle East, everyone knows these writers. It's considered the emigrant school of Arabic literature. So just think of a 1,000-year history of Arabic literature. The modern period has, you know, very few schools within it, and this is a major school. So everyone in the Middle East know these writers. One of the Arab singers recorded a poem by Ilya Abu Mahdi. So she's singing, and it's beautiful. And, you know, so people just love these writers. But in the United States, no one has ever heard of them. And so I went into the field of American history because I wanted to write them into the history books. Because when you see sort of posters of important American women, you never see an Arab woman. You know, when you hear about American feminists, you never hear about Arab American feminist men. So also when you study American poetry, you never hear about, you know, these writers. And I was at the dog park, Ohlone Dog Park, and there was a Cal Berkeley poetry professor, and I mentioned this group of writers, and he'd never heard of them. So it's just, you know, they're writing in New York. They were incredibly influential at the time, but nobody knows about them. And so I really wanted to make this what I wanted to do with my life. But the problem is nobody's heard of them. So if you say you want to give a talk on this, nobody knows what you're talking about. So they just don't even want to hear it. Does that make sense? And so when there is an opening in an ethnic studies department, they'll give it to someone who's done something that people are familiar with rather than something they've never heard of, which is why I'm so frustrated. So thank you.
Hi.
I'm from Germany.
Oh, sorry.
Thank you. I read Khalil Gibran as a child. We learned that in Germany at the school. Uh-huh. It was very, there was a kind of Arabophilia. Uh-huh. And our greatest poet, Goethe, wrote East-West Divan, I mean, all about the Orient.
Okay.
There was great love for it. And I don't know, I assumed that here they would have learned just the same. You know, to broaden your minds and your culture. I mean, this was really mind-expanding, this talk. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hi, Nikki. It's so good to see you again. I loved what you talked about, and it's just so amazing. I love that you're bringing it to the American culture. My question to you is, you mentioned that it's very rife because the latest statistic is that honor-based violence where the daughter is obligated to behave in a way to not shame the family. That's what I struggled with, but the judge granted the restraining order. An interesting statistic, because the UK has a bigger Muslim community, is 36% of Muslims still believe that, you know, that is still the daughter's obligation. My question to you is, you know, with all these forward-thinking progressive writers that were probably way ahead of even American feminist legal studies, how do you think Sharia law was able to encroach like that?
Well, I think, you know, many people are religious fundamentalists, just like they're religious fundamentalists in the United States. And just as you have progressive communities, you know, a lot of times they can't make inroads into fundamentalist, you know, bastions. So I think that's part of the reason why I think this group is so important. But I know that CARA, Council on American Islamic Relations, they're getting daily death threats because people have such a negative idea of what is an Arab man or what is, you know, someone from the Middle East. And so, you know, I'm hoping that if people sort of had a broader understanding of what Arab culture was all about, you know, it would be harder to dehumanize people. I put on the back there a book by Jack Shaheen called Real Bad Arabs. And he documents over, you know, several hundred, probably several thousand movies that were American movies in which the Arabs are the villains and Muslims are the bad guys. You know, you can't watch almost any popular movie without having an Arab terrorist making a guest appearance in the movie somewhere. And, you know, when you think about it, it's just really horrible. You know, you never hear about Arab poets, you never hear about Arab feminists or writers or journalists. So, you know, I think it's easy to humanize people. In Syria, they say that over 300,000 Syrians have been killed. Millions and millions are homeless. People are washing up on beaches in Greece without any clothes. And what is the United States doing? You have politicians who are just, you know, wanting to just get any Syrian immigrants out of the country. You know, it's just really horrible. And over 1,000 rabbis signed a petition saying the turning away of Syrian refugees in the United States is just like the turning away of Jews at the beginning of World War II. And what are we doing, you know? And I think it's been a source of frustration for me.
So. Yeah, thanks so much for reminding people at this group level. And, you know, I remember in the 60s when I went to UC Berkeley, mm-hmm. There were Arabic studies and Middle Eastern studies, and I had colleagues in college that were taking those classes. So I, the way you presented everything today, I just could see you standing at the podium of Dwinelle Hall somewhere and giving a real update for and expanding mm-hmm. people's consciousness. And I really kind of hope that happens. And, you know, my mother gave me Khalil Gibran's The Prophet as a graduation present in 1966. So that just shows you that there was a prominence of at least his work in people's eyesight at that time. And, you know, I think we may be converging on coming back to a more expansionist view of ourselves as an inclusive view of ourselves as Americans, because we know that isolationism and hatred for everybody else in the world is an enemy, except for maybe the English, the white English, it's not going to work. Thank you so much for what you brought today.
Okay. And I just wanted to say really quickly, does everyone understand the idea of Arabic poetry written in two columns? So here you have a traditional poem written in the two columns, and you can see it has the same ending rhyme, which is on the left-hand side. It's the same letter that ends everything. Then you have Rouhani, who wrote prose poetry, which is very different. The next page you have My Brother, which is the poem that I read by Naimi, and you could see how he bridges the two columns at times. He gets away from the two columns at times. So you see how he's sort of tinkering with Arabic poetry. Then you have a picture of Afifa Karam and a picture of The New World, which is her Arabic women's magazine. So this was a copy of her magazine from 1912. You also have pictures of suffragettes, which were in the Arabic newspapers, particularly Al-Huda, which was the national Arabic newspaper that Afifa Karam edited for 6 months when its main editor, Noam Makarzel, was away on sabbatical. So they were very interested in the women's movement and just their different drawings that blend different religious themes together. So.
Oh, I have several quick questions,
okay.
And it's good to see you again.
Okay.
Was Afifa Karam your grandfather's wife, or just...
Yeah,
yeah, okay.
She was married to my grandfather, and then she died, and he married my grandmother, so...
Mm-hmm. And mono-rhyme, what does that mean?
Mono-rhyme, you have to have the same ending rhyme for the entire poem.
Every line?
Every line, like at the
wow.
end of the line, so... Imagine writing a 20-page poem in monorhyme. So it has to be done in two columns, monorhyme and monometer. Isn't that challenging? And then there's 16 meters of Arabic poetry. And again, I gave three examples. These were the easiest because some were just so complicated. It was really hard to type. And I, you know, but imagine trying to maintain a very complicated syllabic meter through an entire poem. It's just really challenging. And that's, I think, part of the reason they wanted to get away from that at times, because it was limiting. But other poets, like Ilya Boumadi, was able to work within that framework.
It would also be challenging to translate it into English, effectively.
Yes, and that's also a big problem. Most of these writings were in Arabic, and many have not been translated into English. It's part of the reason that Americans haven't read a lot of these works. So.
Well, and one quick comment, that I was of the generation that grew up with Khalil Gibran and the Prophet, and when I went to college, that was, you know, I think I only took a few books along, but that was one of
okay.
them, and so was Lawrence Ferlinghetti's book, and then I got moved into my dorm, and there on the other shelf was the Prophet and the Ferlinghetti.
Okay.
You've been talking about it a whole lot. Could you read us just a little bit in Arabic so we could get a sense of what it sounds like?
I'm not going to do that. And actually, in Arabic, the poet is supposed to read his own poetry. So when I was in Alexandria, Egypt, the poets there, one was an amazing poet but was not good at recitation. So his stature as a poet was looked down upon a little bit. That's why, too, to have collectively written verse was considered revolutionary.
So we have just time for one more quick question, if anybody has something.
Can you comment a little bit on Edward Said's Orientalism?
Yeah, so basically, as I mentioned briefly, these writers were writing in New York in the 20s at a time when the King Tut fad was going on. People had just seen movies by Rudolph Valentino, a few years before on The Sheik. And so there was this big sort of fad of the Oriental man. You know, so a lot of white women were sort of enamored by these writers. And so in one sense, it was similar to the Harlem Renaissance, where there was sort of the writers were looked as sort of foreign exotics and romanticized a little bit. So Edward Said's Orientalism, you know, talks about seeing the Orient through this sort of lens. And these writers were very interesting in the sense that they were looking at America and the Middle East from an immigrant perspective. So they were sort of getting away from that a little bit.
Well, thank you so much, Nikki. This was
okay,
very
thank you. Interesting.